Mount, which remember is an introduction for all of Matthew. The rest of Matthew really is going to follow with the Sermon on the Mount and what it has, the stuff that's included. Jesus here begins talking about the various teachings of the scribes and Pharisees. Talks about their the way they teach about murder, that as long as you don't actually pick up a knife and stab your brother, you can hate him all that you want. And Jesus says, no, hate is just as bad. Or they might talk about adultery and the idea of fornication. They're like, well, as long as you don't actually physically touch her, it's fine. And Jesus says, no, you know, doing it within lust, looking at a woman with lustful intent is just as bad. And remember, they had their system set up as far as oaths and vows and such goes, where as long as they, or if they were to swear by, say, the temple, it meant nothing, but if they swore by the gold of the temple, then they were bound to keep it. And Jesus says, that's ridiculous. Just let your yes be yes, let your no be no, and don't worry about all that other stuff. You see, they were teaching a certain thing, and Jesus is coming in, and he's saying, yeah, you got it messed up. This is what true kingdom righteousness is all about. This morning we will continue. It's been a few weeks as we've been doing some other things. This morning we're going to get back into the Sermon on the Mount, and we will continue to look at these various things, these points of comparison that Jesus is making, as we move on now to the next topic that Jesus tackles, that of personal justice, or personal rights, as Jesus discusses the phrase, an eye for an eye, and a tooth for a tooth. Good morning. Boy, it's good to be here this morning, isn't it? It's good to see each other, to be here together, to know that we are here, we're singing together, partaking of the Lord's Supper together, offering prayers together, opening up the Word of God together. It is indeed a wonderful thing to be here. And it's also wonderful to know that folks are joining us from home, that they are here with us in the Spirit. And really, it's not even that they're here with us in the Spirit. It's that we all are before the throne of God in the Spirit. That we worship in Spirit. That we worship there before His throne. And we join each other. It is indeed a great thing. A welcome again to those who are joining in from home or joining in some way. And a welcome to everybody that's here, especially those of you who are visiting with us. We're really glad that you're here. We appreciate that you chose to be here with us this morning. Quite frankly, there's a whole lot of places that you could have gone to worship God this morning, but you chose to be here. And that makes us feel pretty special. It really does. We're glad you're here. And we hope that you will be encouraged by the time that you spend with us this morning as we look into what actually kind of is a timely topic. You're going to come eventually to understand, you know, with the passing of time, you're going to get used to the way that I approach preaching and topics and discussions and things and some of my tendencies. And one of those tendencies is the tendency not to preach on current events. Sometimes it might happen. Sometimes something might take place and I might say, you know, this needs to be dealt with. This needs to be addressed. This is that type of a thing. But I also, I don't like to create reactionary sermons that are just simply put together based on whatever's going on at the time. And I know this runs counter to the way that a lot of people think that it should be, that you should tackle whatever's there at the time that needs to be done. Well, like I said, every now and then that might happen, but normally I just simply try to teach the text. That's all I do. Just open this up. Let's just look at the text in season and out of season. When it's timely, when it's not timely. Because people are usually much more willing to hear what you have to say without getting defensive if what you're discussing is not on the forefront of their minds. If they realize there's no specific agenda that's being driven, it's just easier to say it when nobody is sitting there thinking, is he preaching about me right now? Which usually, no, I'm not addressing a certain individual in the group and preaching at anyone in particular. It's just not very effective. It really isn't. That's why I really like sermon series, you know, especially when you run through a larger text, breaking it down into various sections, like the Sermon on the Mount. It's great for this kind of teaching, because it has all kinds of timeless truths that don't require current events to make them worthwhile discussing. But sometimes, unplanned, purely coincidentally, what I have not put together as a reactionary sermon happens to coincide in a moment of time where it actually carries perhaps a little more weight. I want you to know this. This sermon was put together in 2019. It's gone through some editing, revision, of course. But I did not wake up on Thursday morning after all of the events that took place and decide I need to preach about justice and our place as Christians and where we take our stand in these events. But wouldn't you know, that's the very next section in the Sermon on the Mount that's going to be talked about. So it looks like today I will be looking at a section that perhaps we're going to see some principles that are going to be highly applicable in our society, in which people have been driven to the brink of despair by marginalization and have decided to act in perhaps violent and reprehensible ways. And that's a phenomenon that's been going on for quite some time in our country. And whereas to some degree, I get it. I don't condone it. I do not wish to pretend that nothing has happened. I do not idly stand by and say it's okay. But I get it. I understand the feelings and the things that are behind such actions on both sides for a very long time. And for those who do believe that violence is an answer, that picking up arms is the way to go, that Christians should be involved in any kind of way in this way, let me reintroduce you to Jesus' teachings on the Sermon on the Mount. And really, quite frankly, this is for all of us. As we look into what Jesus teaches here, starting Matthew chapter 5 in verse 38, Jesus says, "You have heard that it was said, an eye for an eye and a tooth for a tooth. But I say to you, do not resist the one who's evil. But if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. If anyone would sue you and take your tunic, let him have your cloak as well. If anyone forces you to go 1 mile, go with him 2 miles. Give to the one who begs from you. Do not refuse the one who would borrow from you." Again, just like every section so far that we've seen in Matthew chapter 5, the Pharisees here are teaching a quotation of some sort from the Old Testament. They're going back to their scriptures. Remember, that was their Bible that they used. And so they are quoting something from the law of Moses and applying it in a way that maybe wasn't the best application. So, like the last few sections, let's go back, see where this law is found in the law of Moses, and let's see how it is they might be misapplying it. Now, this law, an eye for an eye, a tooth for a tooth, this is sometimes called the law of the tooth. Perhaps you've heard the Latin phrase lex talionis, the law of the tooth. That's what this is referring to. It's how it's known. It's a phrase that's found 3 times, and each one of them has its own nuance to it. I have gone through those in the bulletin article, and so sometime today I would, you know, just suggest maybe take a moment to look at all of those accounts in the bulletin article and read through those and see how the Old Testament, how the law of Moses uses this idea and what we can gain from it. Because of that, though, I'm not going to go through each of those here this morning, but I do want to focus on one of them so that we can get an idea in Leviticus chapter 24. And this is probably the least specific, most general use of this phrase. So Leviticus chapter 24, starting in verse 17, here it says, "Whoever takes a human life shall surely be put to death. Whoever takes an animal's life shall make it good, life for life. If anyone injures his neighbor, as he has done, it shall be done to him. Fracture for fracture, eye for eye, tooth for tooth. Whatever injury he has given a person shall be given to him. Whoever kills an animal shall make it good. Whoever kills a person shall be put to death. You shall have the same rule for the sojourner and for the native, for I am the Lord your God." Now, the first thing that we need to notice about this passage right here, he is not referencing personal vengeance. And it's important that we see that. This is not him saying, you go do this to this person. An eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth, fracture for fracture. I think frequently when this phrase is used, when people think about this phrase, they have an idea in their mind of someone who is seeking personal revenge. But it's obvious that that's not what's under discussion, at least not some kind of unauthorized vigilante justice. This is specifically talking about what happens officially within their court of law system. Now, I don't think that the scribes and the Pharisees were taking this as personal revenge. I don't think that's how they understood this. But what they were doing was, like the others, they were focusing on the idea of this being a mandate, this being a command that had to be followed. You see, our society today, it's very litigious. For better or for worse, law is one of the most prominent professions. And lawyers are not going to be out of a job anytime soon. It just is that way. You've probably seen these commercials. Has X, Y, or Z happened to you? Then you deserve just recompense. And we're just the guys to do it. Call 503, number, 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 number. Or if you're in Washington, call 360, number, 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 number. Probably I didn't give enough numbers, but you know what I'm talking about, right? Have you seen those commercials before? You're all nodding. Yeah. It would have been 314 and 618 back in St. Louis. If you're in Missouri or Illinois, you can go anywhere and just change those numbers out. Those commercials are there. Those people are there. Those law firms are there. Our roadsides in this country are littered with billboards from lawyers, opportunistic lawyers. Not all lawyers, mind me, are of the same cloth. We all understand that. You don't want to paint too broad of a brushstroke here. But there are opportunistic lawyers who have all these billboards, probably in the hopes that someone's going to get in an accident on the road, look around with disbelief and rage at what that other person did, and they're going to see that number right there in front of them, and they're going to give it a call because they need to get their due. Our society is full of victims. No matter what happens, if it's negative, we become victims of various circumstances and we seek for restitution. There's not really a high road anymore. Of course, we can't say that we have a monopoly on this type of a mindset. Getting what's yours, getting what you deserve, seeking it out and getting what's due to you, that's been there from the very beginning. You look back in Genesis chapter 4 and starting verse 23. This is right after, by the way, Cain and Abel's story. You have Cain and Abel, and then it follows down a little bit, and then you have this guy named Lamech who comes up. Lamech said to his wives, "Adah and Zillah, hear my voice, you wives of Lamech. Listen to what I say. I killed a man for wounding me. I killed a young man for striking me. If Cain's revenge is sevenfold, then Lamech's is 77-fold. Here's a man who's bragging to his wives about what a great warrior, macho man that they've married, that they've tied themselves to. He goes, "You think Cain is bad? Pooh! I'm the real bad boy around here. This young man struck me, and I killed him for it." This sort of behavior is the reason why the law of the tooth is necessary. keep following just the story of Genesis down the road. Look at the stories of Jacob and Esau and the way that they treat each other. And then the very next generation with Joseph, all of his brothers. And they demonstrate people are willing to do whatever it takes to look out for their own self-interest. Probably one of the greatest illustrations of this in the Bible is Samson. A character who comes to mind who's always looking out for what is his, no matter what. And throughout the Samson story, he has a very skewed view of what justice really is. Usually it's, this was done to me, then justice means that I'm going to have to do two times worse to them. And that's the way that the story of Samson plays out. Throughout history, you can think of people, all kinds of people, they're just simply motivated by self-interest. Even fairness to make sure that justice was done on their behalf. That, ultimately, is what the law of the tooth is all about. The lex talionis, ultimately all it is making sure that justice is done and that justice is fair. So what could possibly be wrong with that, right? I mean, if that's what the Pharisees are teaching right here, that justice needs to be meted out, and it needs to be meted out fairly, shouldn't we be on board with that? You know, our sense of fairness should tell us there's nothing wrong at all with what the Pharisees are teaching. Equity, fairness, the law of the tooth. It's all about equity and fairness. It's making sure that we're not like Samson in our quest for self-interest. We only seek after what rightfully belongs to us and nothing more. An eye for an eye, not life for an eye. That sounds good, right? Well, I don't know. Not necessarily. I mean, consider Jesus speaks out against that. So, there must be something wrong with the mentality. So let's take a look at what Jesus has to say and find out where that deficiency perhaps is. So let's break down Jesus' statement here. It's actually pretty self-explanatory. He gives just very clear examples of this. First, if anyone slaps you on the right cheek, turn to him the other also. This is not, by the way, a demonstration of rebellion. There have been people before who've tried to claim that Jesus was trying to stand in defiance or rebellion with the statement that you don't submit, but you put out your face, you know, to them. No, that's not at all what's taking place here. This is being willing to take a direct hit, which is even more of an insult than the pain. Remember, if someone is slapping you on the right cheek, generally speaking, in right-handed, you know, predominant societies, it means that they are insulting you with a backhanded slap, a backhanded strike. And Jesus says, yeah, be willing not only to accept that, but be willing to accept the full blow as well that would come on the other side of your cheek. That's what Jesus is saying. He goes on in the next statement, if anyone would sue you and take your tunic, give him the cloak as well. This one's a little more difficult, perhaps, but it probably carries the same force as the last statement. If somebody is suing you in order to hurt you, be willing to be hurt. And be ready, if necessary, to give the inner and the outer tunics. I mean, that's what's under discussion here. Are y'all familiar with the way that they would clothe themselves, that they had two different tunics, that they would wear an inner one? You know, we might call it like underwear type of a thing, but it's not fully that. But it's an inner tunic, and then you have your outer one. Yeah, that's the way that it was. Which, by the way, you rarely, if you're kind of a poor individual in those days, you rarely have more than two changes of clothing. And so losing a full change of clothing is a big deal. And he says, be willing. If someone's suing you for the outer tunic, be willing to give them that inner one as well, if the situation calls for it. He says, if anyone compels you to go a mile, go another one with them. Now, this one's actually very specific to Jesus' day and the situation that they were in with the Roman occupation itself. Remember, Rome occupied Israel. Israel was subject to them. They were, you know, the main governing thing. And they had a massive empire with roads that went all the way through the empire so that the armies were able to quickly move from one point of the empire to the other. It was actually a pretty good system for the day. Well, remember, the Israelites just hated the idea that anybody would actually rule over them. And so this really was a problem for them. Because as the armies were traveling, remember, their gear is kind of heavy. And so what they could do to any of these subjugated nations out there, if they're traveling by a field and they're like, all right, I need a break from my armor and gear for a bit, they could just point to a person and say, hey, come here, come out of the field, carry my gear for a mile. And they'd have to do it. That was part of the law. That's what helped the Roman armies move so quickly from one place to another, is that they could have their gear relieved, be relieved of carrying their gear. And a proper Jew would know that he had to do it for 1 mile. And he would know exactly how long that 1 mile is. And he would carry the gear step by step up to the mile and then drop it on the ground and walk away with disdain. A way of just kind of, getting back at the fact that they made him do this. Feeling sick inside that he'd helped a Roman soldier. It's saying, all right, I know I got to do this, but I'm going to hate it every second of the way. I'm going to get to the end, and I'm going to treat you as poorly as I can treat you and get back to what I was doing before. Jesus says what you should be doing is saying, you know what, I'll do another mile with you. But let me not only go what I have to do, but let me take it another mile. Unheard of. Nobody did that for the Roman soldier. He says, if anyone begs you or wants to lend, do not neglect. Instead, be willing to give. Again, Jesus is not mandating things as much as he's saying, this is what kingdom citizenship looks like. When you're confronted with someone who has a need, a kingdom citizen will help in that need. Whether it's a beggar or someone who's even just asking for a loan. And quite frankly, in practice, I think both are the same. Be willing to give. The person who's asking for a loan usually is doing so because he doesn't have money. So don't give the money. Don't lend the money to someone expecting to see that money again. That's just not a good practice. Because if you do so, if he's unable to repay that, that's going to cause divisions, problems. It will tear the relationship up. And it will ruin more than it's going to help. Loan the money. Give it to them. Let them have it. If they repay it, great. That's fine. But don't give it expecting the repayment, or you're setting yourself up for a problem. There's a reason that both of these, the beggar, the loan, these are put in the same spot together. Be willing to give. The point is not be willing to loan. The point is to be able to look at someone and say, I see a need. Let me help this need. Whatever the case is. That's what Jesus is trying to get across. Now, the key to all of this, all of these different points, is the phrase that he starts this out with when he says, do not resist the one who is evil. Think about that statement for just a second. Do not resist the one who is evil. I don't know, maybe you might be thinking, is there a typo in there? Did he accidentally, put the word not, and he didn't actually mean to do that? Because we're all pretty familiar with James 4, are we not? Submit yourselves, therefore, to God. Resist the devil. Resist the evil one, and he will flee from you. And so which one are we supposed to do? Are we supposed to resist the evil one? Or are we supposed to not resist the evil one? And, quite frankly, it's not because James is not familiar with Jesus' teaching that he writes this. Even though James would have been written before Matthew, as far as chronological order, you can cross-reference so many things straight out of the book of Matthew in the book of James, written by, remember, Jesus' brother. He was very familiar with Jesus' teaching. He was very familiar with the Sermon on the Mount. He was very familiar with this. So how does James say, resist the evil one, when Jesus himself says, do not resist the one who is evil? Well, James is very specifically talking about humbling yourself before God in chapter 4 and resisting Satan on a spiritual level. It's resisting Satan and who and what you are. This is like when Peter talks about resisting the devil. It's the very same idea in your attitude, your mentality. Do not give in to him. Jesus is talking about physical resistance. Jesus is talking about that moment in the physical altercation that's going on against you. He says, don't put up a fight. If you are being persecuted, it's not your job to put your hands up and say, okay, let's duke this out. He says, when you are in that situation where your cheek has been struck, your job is not to strike theirs back. Yours is to turn the other cheek, to present the other cheek, and not to resist the one who is doing evil against you. In other words, don't make a scene over this. This goes specifically to what Jesus has already said, right? Blessed are those who are persecuted for the sake of righteousness. Blessed are you when others revile and persecute you, and they utter all kinds of evil against you falsely on my account. He says, rejoice and be glad, not because you're going to be able to get your punishment against them immediately. He says, rejoice and be glad because the reward in heaven is great. You don't have to stand up for yourself right there and duke it out with the one. You resist him. God sees it, and he says, your reward in heaven is great. For the way that you are handling this situation without resisting that evil one. You know, this is kind of a lot like what we're seeing in our Wednesday night class in 1 Peter chapter 4. Don't let any of you suffer as a murderer or a thief or an evildoer or as a meddler. Yet, if anyone suffers as a Christian, let him not be ashamed. Let him glorify God in that name. For it is time for judgment to begin at the household of God. And if it begins with us, what will be the outcome for those who do not obey the gospel of God? And then he quotes, if the righteous is scarcely saved, what will become of the ungodly and the sinner? Therefore, let those who suffer according to God's will entrust their souls to a faithful Creator while doing good. Where do those who have been wronged entrust themselves? They don't entrust themselves to themselves. It's not their job to stand up for themselves in the moment and prove and to get their own revenge or vengeance. They entrust themselves to God. They don't take their own revenge. Remember, Peter was there on that mountain hearing this sermon as it was being given. He knows what he's talking about. Now, Paul, on the other hand, was not there on that mountain. He didn't hear this sermon, so far as we know. There's no indication of it. And yet, even he, in Romans chapter 12, starting verse 18, says, if possible, so far as it depends on you, live peaceably with all. Beloved, never avenge yourselves. Leave it to the wrath of God. For as it is written, vengeance is mine, I will repay, says the Lord. To the contrary, if your enemy is hungry, you feed him. If he's thirsty, you give him something to drink, for by so doing, you will heap burning coals on his head. Do not be overcome by evil. Instead, overcome evil with good. Where does Paul say that proper vengeance comes from? Vengeance is mine, I will repay, declares the Lord. So what is the job of the individual who has been wronged? The individual who's had his cheek slapped or his tunic taken or has walked the mile? What's the job of that individual? The job of that individual is to say, you know what, God, I'm going to leave this in your hands. I'm going to let you take care of whatever vengeance that needs to be had. And yeah, I believe it needs to be had, but I'm going to trust you. And what I'm going to do is I am going to kill this person with kindness. I'm going to do the exact opposite of what they expect, of what the world expects, of what everyone expects. There is no eye for an eye, tooth for a tooth. There's only me helping, loving, doing what I can as far as it's possible to be at peace. And being at peace doesn't always mean that you're going to be at peace, because quite frankly, not everybody wants to be at peace with you. It's a lesson, you know, that I'm sure you have learned that. Any of you who have lived any amount of time, you've learned that. Not everyone wants to be at peace with you. You can't do anything about that. But your job, on your end, if there's no peace, there's peace as far as you're concerned. You live peaceably with them. And if there's any broken peace, it's on their end. It's not on yours. That's what we're supposed to see. And you see this principle. And in 1 Corinthians chapter 6, I am fully aware. I am switching up context just a little bit here. This isn't talking about persecution coming from without. This is referring to people who are taking Christians to a public court of law, going outside of the church in order to, you know, handle problems and stuff going on. And Paul's saying, really? That's kind of ridiculous, isn't it? Can't you handle stuff yourself? Aren't you able to do this? Well, in that context, there's a principle that I think is very important, and it does carry over. In verse 7, you know, verses 5 through 7, Paul says, I say this to your shame. Can it be that there's no one among you who's wise enough to settle a dispute between the brothers? But brother goes to law against brother, and that before unbelievers? To have lawsuits at all with one another is already a defeat for you. And then he says, why not just suffer the wrong? Why not be defrauded? Why not be willing to let your personal rights be violated in some kind of a way? Understanding that there is something greater that's going on here. In the grand scheme of things, is it really that important that you get yours? Is your own self-interest your highest priority? Because if your highest priority is actually that other person, the sinner who does not know God, your brother who's in a difficult place, that family member who maybe left the Lord and you're trying to lead them back, whomever it is, as Paul says in Philippians chapter 2, don't look out for your own self-interest. Instead, look out for the interest of others. Regard one another as more important than yourselves. Folks, I can't stress how important this principle is. For Christians, protecting our rights is not the most important thing. For us, demonstrating Christ to the world is the most important thing. And when you think about it, doesn't he give a pretty good example to follow? Remember what it is that Jesus has taught us. He says, when you are struck, don't strike back. Don't seek your own revenge. Leave it to God. Be willing to suffer for God's sake. When you're sued, be willing to lose what's rightfully yours. And even more, don't worry about it. God is seeing what is taking place, and you will be vindicated eventually. You are gaining a reward in heaven that is great when you do this. When you are called upon to go a mile, be willing to accept the governance of the Romans or whatever oppressive government is over you, and joyfully accept the harsh restraints and go even further beyond, knowing that God is watching you do it and your reward in heaven is great. And when you see those who are in need, be willing to help them, especially monetarily, to help ease the problems. One of the greatest callings throughout the entirety of Scriptures is to help those who are unable to help themselves. One of the greatest things that we can do. You know, in the last few lessons, as we've been going through the Sermon on the Mount, we've been able to look later in the book of Matthew, his gospel, and we've been able to find some section by which Jesus expands the teaching, and he gives a little more commentary to what he's saying. Well, Jesus doesn't really have another section where he teaches about he teaches them and has some section about allowing yourself to be wronged by the evil ones. Instead, you go towards the end of the gospel, and he lives it. If anyone slaps you on the right cheek, we'll look at Matthew chapter 26. Then they spit in his face, and they struck him. And some slapped him, saying, "Prophesy to us, you Christ. Who is it that struck you?" He could have easily struck back. Or perhaps go into 27 and verse 30. They spit on him. These are the Roman soldiers who were about to take him to be crucified. They spit on him. And they took the reed and they struck him on the head. And when they'd mocked him, they stripped him of the robe. And they put his own clothes back on him. And then they led him away to crucify him. How did Jesus act when he was struck in the face? He says, if anyone would sue you for your tunic or your inner garment, let him have the outer one also. Matthew 27:35, when they had crucified him, they took his garments and they divided them amongst them by casting lots. They took, very specifically, his tunic from him in order to take it for themselves, an action that he did not stop. If anyone forces you to go a mile, perhaps Jesus didn't have to carry a soldier's pack for a mile. We don't know. Maybe he did sometime in his life. We don't have it recorded in the Gospels, but that doesn't mean that Jesus was not called upon to join the Roman army at one point in a march through the city of Jerusalem. It says, when they had mocked him, they stripped him of the robe, put his own clothes on him, and led him away to crucify him. And as they went out, they found a man of Cyrene, Simon by name. They compelled this man to carry his cross. As Jesus was led through the streets of Jerusalem in a walk of shame by which everybody would line the streets, hurling abuses, throwing things, these are people who are worthy of the worst that you could give to them. They've demonstrated by the fact that they're going to hang on the tree. They're cursed by God. They're worthy of spitting upon, throwing stuff at, yelling, screaming, everything else. And the Jews, by the way, were more than happy to do so for those who were worthy for this to take place in their minds. We all know he wasn't worthy. But that's the way they viewed it. That's the way they saw it. And this idea, give to the one who begs from you, do not refuse the one who would borrow again. There's no very specific record of this. Throughout, though, the Gospels, Jesus has compassion upon people and does things to help them, to take care of them, to heal them, whatever the situation might be. But I will say this, why does Jesus even endure the cross to begin with? Why does he receive all the abuse that he receives? Why was he struck on the cheek? Why was he shamed and displayed publicly naked while the soldiers took his clothing? Why was he forced through the streets of Jerusalem as a common criminal to die one of the most cruel deaths that has ever been imagined? Why did he die in shame on that cross nearly 2,000 years ago? Let me suggest it was because I needed it. You needed it. We all needed it. And in a collective way, we all cry out for salvation. We are all debtors. We are all poor, impoverished in spirit. And we are begging God. To provide for us what we cannot provide for ourselves. He does it. In a collective way, as we cry out for salvation, begging in need for the help that only God in the flesh could provide, that salvation comes to us freely, without any strings, without repayment necessary. It's just given. And folks, Jesus could have resisted this. Remember when he was going to be taken and Peter pulled out the sword and Jesus said, look, just put the sword back in its place. For all who take the sword will perish by the sword. Do you not think that I could appeal to my Father and he'll at once send more than 12 legions of angels? How then should the scriptures be fulfilled that it must be so? He lets us know he very clearly did not have to go through this. You know, 12 legions, that's just a full army is all that means. You know, it's just, he had a full army of angels at the ready, snaps his fingers, there they are to do what he was going to do or would want them to do. He could have, but he didn't. Instead, he said, I will be wronged here so they can be made right. As Peter puts it, again, another passage we've talked about, since, therefore, Christ suffered in the flesh, arm yourselves with the same way of thinking. For whoever has suffered in the flesh has ceased from sin, so as to live the rest of the time in the flesh no longer for human passion, but for the will of God. Folks, if we're going to be like Christ, then we must be willing to be wrong. We must be willing to suffer. We must be willing to help. We must be willing to give. We must be willing to live our lives to God, to live our lives to the praise of His glory, to live our lives just as Jesus lived his. You know, the world says an eye for an eye, but Jesus not only taught, but he lives a better way. And he calls us to do the same. Will you pray with me? Our great and amazing God, we bow before you and we honor you as our glorious God, worthy of all praise. Though it is sometimes difficult, we trust you. And we know, even when we are wronged, you see it, and we can count on you to right all the wrongs. Even if we never see them righted ourselves, we still put our hope to you. Leva, help us. Help us to leave the things with you. Give us a peace that passes understanding, a peace that we can have with all, even with those who hurt us and persecute us. Help us to look forward to our reward in heaven as a greater desire than any immediate revenge or vengeance. We love you for being willing to experience, through the sending of your Son, what this hurt is all about. We thank you for Jesus, for his suffering, for his death, which gives us hope in life. And it is through Jesus we now pray. Amen. Again, as I stated earlier, this sermon, this discussion, all of this was not put together based on current events. This is put together because this is what Jesus taught. If there's any overlap, if there's any application, or whatever the case is, I will leave it to you. I hope you noticed that I didn't try to pigeonhole various things in there. I just simply said, this is what's there. This is what Jesus teaches. And I would hope that you would look for yourself to see, where do I fit in? Where does my attitude fit in? Where does my hope fit in? Because we need to put our hope in the Lord. He is the one who takes care of all wrongs. He is the one who gave himself free so that we could be made right. If there's anyone here this morning and you understand, that you need to be made right before God. You understand that you need to be baptized into the blood of Christ for the forgiveness of your sins. You understand that that is something that God has done for you so that you could be perfect and blameless before Him and spend eternity with Him. And if you are ready to make this commitment, we're going to sing a song in just a moment, that song being Hand in Hand with Jesus. As we sing this song, if you are ready to make that commitment to be baptized into the blood of Christ for the forgiveness of your sins, then as we sing and simply come to the front, have a seat, and we'll assist you. If we can help you in any way, please come forward as we sing this song.